This is Car Expert.
This was a car you could literally throw into a corner, and I've not been able to say that about an M3 or an M4 for some time.
Mitsubishi's had it all to itself. Well, now they've got a little bit of competition with the MG HS plug-in hybrid.
There's been a little bit of argy-bargy between Honda and its dealers, which is inevitable when you make major structural changes.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner, and hello to Scott Colley.
Hey, Mandy.
And William Stopford.
And hello to Mandy.
I love a good van. And I noticed on the site, Will, Hyundai have leaked a very futuristic-looking van. Tell us about it.
It's not often that I say that is a really freaking cool van, but okay. That is a really freaking cool van. It's just – so this is the Staria, right? So Hyundai released the teaser today, and this we've also seen a leaked photo of it as well. So the Staria replaces the IMAX. And there's also a cargo version that will replace the iLoad. And this thing, I mean, if you anybody who is listening to this podcast hasn't actually seen it yet, I'm not going to really be able to describe it, but I'll try. It kind of imagine like a Starfleet like shuttlecraft from Star Trek. Like that's what this looks like. It's got this dramatically sloped front, and it just forms this continuous arc, and it just does not look like any other van on the market. It looks like a concept car, but you know, from you know, this is actually a production vehicle, and it's just I gotta tip my hat, if I had a hat, to Hyundai, because they're really taking design risks lately, but some of them have been paying off really well. Now I haven't seen the new Tucson in person yet. I've heard mixed things about that, but that Ioniq 5, for example, is just a design I wasn't expecting. To just go from concept to production with virtually no changes. So this Staria just absolutely blew my mind.
Yeah.
And I might be maybe the only Aussie journo to point this out. It does have a bit of a resemblance to the 1990 GM U-body minivans. So if any
really?
Americans or Canadians are listening, compare them side by side. The silhouette of both, funnily enough, one of those minivans was called the Oldsmobile Silhouette. but I don't want to sell the Hyundai short. It is a really, really modern, dramatic design, and the interior looks really nice too, and I'm really excited to see it in the metal.
The thing that gets me is, like, Hyundai and Apple have been rumored to be in a tie-up, and then Kia and Apple were rumored to be in a tie-up, and this, in my head, is what the Apple autonomous car would or will look like. It just looks like an Apple mouse, essentially. It's got a little grill on the bottom and some headlights, but it's so crisp and so simple, the shape of it, that it is very, very Apple. I think it's quite cool.
And yet, ironically, they seem to be shifting away from IMAX and iLoad and those very Apple-esque
names.
Oh,
that's very true.
Yeah.
So. I quite like the low window line on the side there.
So used to seeing these like really steeply raked belt lines nowadays and such poor visibility. So to see a car with like 80s Honda level of low belt line is, wow. Yeah.
Just make
and the
sure.
White van has some steelies too. I'm all for that.
Just make sure if you're sitting in the back that you're dressed well from the waist down, because usually the window line only gets you sort of chest up. But if the window line is that low and the seat's high enough, maybe the top of your legs is on show as well and you need to wear your good pants in the car.
Or just wear pants in general.
Yes, that would be a great idea. Guys, I went to probably one of the biggest Porsche events in Australia, the inaugural Luftwasser, which means air, water in German, so air-cooled, water-cooled Porsches.
Oh.
This was in Albury, and it went over 3 days, so we had a long weekend in Victoria on the Monday, and huge collection of all different sorts of cars. You had the 914s, 928s, right up to the latest generation 911, and Porsche Center Melbourne brought the new Taycan to display on the first day, and boy, did it get some attention. Highly well-organized event. We had a couple of drive days to a winery. We went to Gingellic Pub. And we had a track day on the Sunday, so we got a chance to take our cars around a track and just have a bit of fun. It wasn't timed or anything. It was just for people to get out and blow the cobwebs out of their cars. So I took my 356 replicas were welcome, which was really lovely, and drove it up there. I didn't trailer it. I drove it myself up to Albury, so a 3-4 hour trip from Melbourne, and got there and found a oil leak underneath the car the size of my open palm after about 10 minutes. which is not normal. Volkswagen people say, oh, yeah, leak, you know, engines leak oil all the time. That's fine. But no, this was more than just a leak. So sadly, my car couldn't go around the track on the Sunday, but the Porsche people really stepped up, and this is what made the event for me. The camaraderie, the spirit of community in that group was incredible. I was sitting next to a man at dinner, and I only spoke to him for about 15 minutes. He knew me for 15 minutes, and he said, I'm really sorry to hear you can't take your car on track tomorrow. I said, look, that's okay. I just don't want to damage it anymore. I'm comfortable with not doing it. And he said, look, I've got a 1970s 911 RSR. For people who don't know what these are, this was like a Porsche 911 made just to race on the track, and this thing is fat. Like, it's just the bee's knees. And that you said, look, I'll give you the keys tomorrow. Just take it around the track. Have a bit of fun with it.
Unbelievable.
And I said, no, I can't do that. I know it's a valuable car. And I'm only just mentioning. He goes, no, seriously, do it. I'm like, okay. Like, as motoring journalists, we've driven some pretty cool cars, modern and old, but this thing just beats them all. The rawness of that car. I had a helmet on, so it obviously was covering my ears quite a lot, but I could still hear that roar of that engine. It was quick. The transmission was actually surprisingly easy to handle, hard to get offline from a standstill. But once the tires warmed up, it just stuck to that track like you would not believe. I had to sort of just take it easy at the beginning. I'm like, holy crap, this car is worth so much money and it's not mine. I don't want to crash it. But it a completely unforgettable experience. And I've got to thank the Porsche people who really got on board helping us, trying to get the car back and all sorts of stuff like that. So it turned a very disappointing weekend into a weekend of just so much happiness. So,
how is your car now?
It is currently on a trailer as we speak, coming from Albury to my mechanic here in Melbourne. And the worst part is we had a brief look underneath because it's so low, it's hard to really get a good look. But it's a could be a possible rear main seal that has broken, which my Beetle did that about 18 months ago.
Oh, God, I remember and this it was saga.
I know. It was an engine rebuild, which cost thousands of dollars. So, yeah, cars are expensive.
Yeah,
I'm
actually a bit relieved, and not this has happened to you because I don't want anything bad to happen to your cars. They're beautiful. But last time that Beetle engine blew, I think I might have been the last person to drive it before it packed up.
Yes.
I've driven Mandy's car before. We took some photos of it for something we did at the old place, but I needed to be moved around the block at our old office. And I was the only one in the office who'd actually driven it before. Mandy was out and someone goes, Scott, can you move that car? And I drove it very gently around the block and parked it back where it needed to go. And the next day, Mandy goes, my Beetle is just not working. It's just given up. And it
I blame
didn't
you.
Drive for 18 months after that. So I suppose I'm really sorry to hear your 356 is not working.
But did I also feel a little bit. One too? You're going to jail, Scott.
A very special hell for Porsche and Beetle hating people who break cars. But
yes.
Yeah, at least it wasn't my fault this time. It wasn't my fault last time either, but
no, it wasn't. Okay. So yeah, I'll keep you posted on this brand new saga of classic car ownership. Good times.
Tune in the middle of 2026 to hear how it's resolved.
Oh my God. We'll live vicariously through you because whenever I hear these stories, I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to pull the trigger on getting a second.
Yeah, don't. Let's get into this week's news. Over to you, Scully, first. The 2021 Hyundai Kona N. We finally have timing confirmed for this model.
It has been a big week for the Hyundai graphics department. On top of the Staria that we talked about in the intro where they released some really shadowy photos, they also took some pictures of the new Kona N and made them just a little bit darker to make us guess a little bit about how it's going to look. But, yeah, we now know that the i30N's slightly taller brother is going to be in Australia during the third quarter of 2021, which is big news because the i30N is obviously it's one of our favorite hot hatches. But people want SUVs at the moment. And so Hyundai will have finally a dual clutch transmission and a performance SUV. It'll be kind of unique in that space because the Volkswagen T-Roc R is not due here for another 12 months at least. And the Kona N will come and give people who want to go fast, sit a little bit higher and look kind of cool, something to buy, which can only be a good thing. We're expecting the Kona N to share pretty much everything under the skin with the i30N. So that means it'll get a turbo 2-liter four-cylinder engine and a new 8-speed dual clutch. Hyundai hasn't confirmed whether a manual will be available, nor whether the cheaper, slower base model will be available overseas. We don't get that version of the i30N in Australia. If I had to take a punt, I would say it's likely to be front-wheel drive, automatic only, and performance only, especially in Australia where we love the best of the best. It's going to be the fast one with the automatic, and if you want a manual, you can buy the hatchback.
Pity it's not all-wheel drive.
It is a bit of a pity, but I think also one of the great things about that i30N is that it's a bit raucous, and potentially partly because Hyundai only does a front-wheel drive version of that powertrain, but also partly because N still kind of stands for a bit rough around the edges but great fun to throw around. I think it's quite cool that Hyundai's not wanted to dilute that character too much yet, and it's just gone, it's an SUV, but it's still wild, have fun, and throwing the i30N powertrain in there. So, yeah, I definitely love the idea of a little rally-style all-wheel drive Kona N, but I can see this front-wheel drive one being pretty serious fun as well.
But the interesting thing about the Kona is it doesn't have very SUV-y styling, if you will. It's a little quirky, but it's not like a Kia Seltos, right? It's not this kind of bluff, SUV-looking type vehicle. And it's not massively larger than an i30 or massively more practical. So who is actually going to pay, and I presume it's going to be more expensive than a comparable i30, who is actually going to pay extra to get the Kona N over an i30N when the Kona N doesn't have all-wheel drive or anything dramatically different from the i30?
I think there are plenty of people out there who just want to look a bit different, and that's what the Kona has always done. It's always looked interesting, and I think even with the facelift, it still stands out compared to the hatchback. It's still taller and it's still more distinctive. It's got the double headlights and the funky overbitey kind of grille that the i30 doesn't. So I think the space for that car isn't necessarily going to be, I want to be really tall and practical and boxy. But it's going to be those people who go, well, I just really want to stand out and I really want to show the world that I am an individual and here I am. And there's plenty of those people out there, because by that same logic, the normal Kona wouldn't sell over the i30, the T-Roc wouldn't sell over the Golf. We think about these things a little differently, I think, sometimes as journos who sort of go, right, but the bones are the same. But, I mean, yeah, punters have shown that there is a market for people who just want something that looks a bit different and feels a bit taller.
Okay, we will move on now to the 2021 Genesis G70. It has been detailed, Scully. I actually don't mind the look of this thing.
It does look very good, doesn't it? The GV70 is Genesis's second SUV. It's smaller than the GV80 that we get in Australia at the moment, and it's probably going to be a better seller as well. It's going to go head-to-head with the BMW X3 and the Audi Q5 when it arrives. And there's going to be heaps and heaps of choice. One of the things we've seen from some car makers is that as Australian sales are small compared to the rest of the world and emissions challenges and production challenges through COVID and all that sort of thing have really hit, they've gone, well, to make things easy, we're going to give Australia one engine and one spec. Genesis is taking the opposite approach. It's giving us three different powertrains. We've got a 2.5-litre turbo petrol, a 2.2-litre diesel, and a 3.5-litre V6 petrol, along with the choice of front-wheel drive or all-wheel drive in that base engine. And then there's also a couple of options packages, like a sport package that really makes this thing look quite distinctive. I mean, no Genesis looks like a BMW, but the Bentley kind of style headlights and the sloping profile of this GV70 with sports wheels and a blacked-out exterior looks really, really cool. And there's also a luxury package that lets you add a whole lot more equipment again that either you aren't able to get or you're forced to spend big bucks on the top engine in some rival brands to get on their cars. So I really love the approach Genesis is taking. We don't know pricing yet, so I'm not a gambling man. I'm not going to take a punt on it, but we do know that Genesis does its fixed price model and it has far fewer dealers than the Germans and its Japanese rivals. So when this car does arrive, the price you see on the page is the price you are actually going to pay unless they're doing a special offer. And to drive one, you're going to need to go and visit a showroom that they call a boutique in Sydney. There's some opening up in Melbourne and Brisbane. Or you can contact them if you live within a certain distance of the city and they'll bring a car for you to drive. But because of that, I think no matter how good the product is, it's still going to remain a bit of a smaller player than what we're used to from the Q5 and the X3. Will, I know you love Genesis so much you bought one. What are your thoughts on this?
Look, I think it looks fantastic. And I was speaking to Albors and I think Croft as well, who actually got to see one in the metal. And apparently, yeah, it looks great in the metal too. And it's got a really, really nice looking interior as well. Kudos as well to Genesis for rolling out rear wheel drive and rear and all wheel drive crossovers instead of just doing, you know, rebodied versions of Hyundai and Kia models. So that's really exciting because this means that every single Genesis product, including that upcoming electric vehicle, is going to be either rear or all-wheel drive. So, I mean, that's always good. I prefer rear-wheel drive to front-wheel drive in a vehicle like this, probably, yeah. But, yeah, it looks great. You're absolutely right about the pricing, though. At the end of the day, people are going to say if it's not dramatically lower than a German rival, they are going to say that it is a bit too expensive. I found this, and that being said, it's not saying that the kind of people that are commenting this are the people who are in the market to buy one, but a lot of people say, oh, well, it's not that much cheaper than the Germans. But then you say, well, if you look spec for spec, Genesis loads its cars up with more features than a German manufacturer typically does. Yeah, pricing, I think, is going to be a bit of a psychological hurdle. And that whole geographic hurdle of not having anything more than a studio and a test drive center in New South Wales and studios in Melbourne and Brisbane still yet to be opened is certainly going to hamstring Genesis. But, I mean, talk about getting, like, a fantastic array of product out when you roll out a new brand. I can't wait to get behind the wheel of this.
Yeah, they've rolled out quite a few models in such a short space of time. So exciting times for Genesis. Another exciting car here, Will, the 2021 Mercedes-Maybach GLS 600. We have all the details for this one.
Yes. So the Mercedes-Maybach GLS 600 4MATIC has been priced for Australia. So this was actually revealed back in 2019. It's finally making its way here. It's going to arrive here in August in limited numbers because this is set to be a very exclusive vehicle. So this is the first Maybach branded SUV. And if you compare it to a regular Mercedes GLS, yeah, it's quite a bit more expensive. If you compare
it.
Yes. Well, I'll say just quite how expensive in a moment. But if you compare it, which I'm sure Mercedes would love you to do, to a Rolls-Royce Cullinan, it is quite a bit cheaper. So at $358,300
for
costs.
Ouch.
Yeah, I know. That's more than twice as much as an entry-level Mercedes-Benz GLS 450. It's $68,400 more than the more powerful Mercedes-AMG GLS 63, which also runs a twin-turbo 4-litre V8 engine but puts out more power and torque. But it is $300,000 less than a Rolls-Royce Cullinan. So, glass half empty.
So what do you get for that extra hike?
We actually get more and less. So
okay.
What they've done is they've said, you're not going to be hauling around people in the third row of this. So they got rid of the third row, of course. And they've actually pushed the second row back 120 mils, millimeters. Now, you have got the option of either having three seats in the back, why would you, or two seats because there's this executive rear package which replaces the center rear seat with a fixed console. That's available with extending folding tables. It's available with a refrigerator with a space for your champagne bottles. The two rear seats, the two outboard rear seats in with both seating layout options have heating, ventilation, power adjustability, and massaging functions, which is,
of course,
it's funny that it's kind of taken so long for manufacturers to roll out ultra luxury SUVs, because if you think about it, who wants to stoop down into a sedan? You want to step up into yes. an SUV, and you don't have to step up too far with this because it actually lowers and slides out a little retractable running board to help you get into it.
This is sounding amazing.
Yes. There's also a chauffeur mode, which it reduces the number of gear shifts while you're driving. It always starts in a second. It deactivates the automatic stop-start, so there's no unseemly mechanical goings-on to disturb your travel. Everything is covered in Nappa leather. There's a big panoramic sunroof. There's extra sound insulation compared to a GLS. It uses, as I said before, a twin turbocharged 4-litre V8 engine with 410 kilowatts of power and 730 newton meters of torque. It does have a 48-volt mild hybrid system, which is said to improve fuel economy. Fuel economy figures haven't been released for it just yet. Look, I'm curious to see what y'all think of how it looks, because when I look at it, that two-tone paint jobs really suited cars in the 70s, right? Because they were more angular. It allowed for a two-tone paint trim to look a little better. Whereas this, even though it's an SUV, it's quite curvy. So I think that is a little controversial. And the fact that those are, when will it end, 23-inch alloy wheels.
Wow.
And all that exterior chrome, it looks a little, I don't know if people still say it, blingy.
Those wheels definitely make it look blingy.
I think you're being nice to it.
And the front grille as well.
You're being very nice to it. It is ostentatious and yuck. It's garish and just yuck, 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 yuck. Oh, I love a big luxury car, and Merc does some of the nicest ones out there. But God, I don't know. I just, why does it need to be burgundy on burgundy?
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Why does the grille look like a cut price mobster's suit? It's like average pinstripes. Yeah. I just don't understand it. I know I'm not meant to, because I can't afford one, and I wouldn't want to be chauffeured around if I could anyway. But yeah, the whole thing just makes me want to go and vomit somewhere.
Is that everything you're feeling right now?
Oh, not really. I'm also a little bit tired, and I like to talk about my relationship, but that's besides the point. Why have they made it like baby? Oh, I can't say that on the podcast either. Baby. Why have they made it like soft and slightly suggestive brown?
It is actually
inside.
Now you've pointed it out.
Oh, I just don't. None of it. I understand, and I know that I'm not meant to, and I can respect the engineering that goes into creating something like this, because, like, chauffeur mode and the step out, the pop out steps, and the fact that the air suspension will probably make it ride like a dream, even though it's on wheels bigger than most trains have. All of that is so incredibly impressive, and I understand why the market for these cars exists, but I just look at that and I just go, oh, no thank you, no thank you, no thank you, no thank you.
It's the regular GLS is such a good looking SUV. Mm.
It is.
So, and I know that they've really, if you're going to be charging that much more for it, you've really got to make it stand out and look different. I wonder if this is really going to click with that kind of like high profile celebrity crowd that they're probably waiting to buy this, like your rappers and basketball players and people like that. And actors. I really do wonder if it's going to resonate with them, or if they're just going to look at this and think, well, I can just customize a regular GLS to look better than this. Or just buy a Cullinan.
They're not going to worry about it. I think that, to be honest, the point with a car like this is that you either like it or you don't, and get the hell out of my way.
Least like when you're being chauffeured in it, you're not looking at it from the outside. You'd be just probably closing your eyes or sipping some champagne in the back seat. So,
and I assume that, wouldn't be too fast. You can get different interior colorways as well. So you probably can get a beautiful blue and white that will look fantastic against whatever clothing your passengers are wearing. And, this is the sort of car that if you were a big high-level power exec and you need to go on a trip with someone, you go, get in the back with me and let's talk business. I can see how it could be much nicer than it is, but the one photographed. Oh.
Yeah, it's a very interesting colorway, isn't it? Very interesting to see a Maybach roll off the production line in the US, though. So that's
really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Because all GLS and GLE models are made in Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
I believe it's Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Yeah,
there we go. Mercedes Maybach.
Now we're just going to get on Mike Costello very shortly to talk more Honda news. But before we do, Scully, are we going to get the cute little Honda E here to Australia?
We might be. We might be getting it, which is very exciting. This is the opposite of the Maybach. It is small and it is neat and reserved in its detailing.
Tasteful.
And it is very efficient as cars go. So the Honda E, it was based on a concept that essentially looked just like a modern version of the first-gen Civic. And it's been put into production for Japan and for Europe, but Australia's always said, look, we'd love to have it, but we just kind of can't get it. One of the questions we put to Stephen Collins, who is the boss of Honda Australia, when we spoke to him last week, was with lower sales volumes and hopefully higher margins, which we'll talk about shortly with Mike, will you be able to start sourcing some cars from Japan at slightly higher prices that maybe you couldn't previously? And his response was essentially, look, we can't confirm anything, but we think there are opportunities there. There's definitely more scope for it. And we're pretty excited about the idea. So that's a paraphrase, obviously. The actual quote is published on Car Expert. So yeah, essentially that means that like the E is still on the table for Australia. It's still something we could get here. It would likely be a pretty expensive niche kind of rival to the Mini Electric. But potentially we could see Honda's cute little city car down under, and that is very exciting.
Fingers crossed. It's such a cute little thing. And you can see that Honda's new design language is very clean sides, very unadorned. And it all kind of started with the E. But the E really is the most pure distillation of that design language. It's retro, it's futuristic, it's clean, it's unadorned, it looks fantastic. It would certainly get attention. And you're right as well. It wouldn't ever be a high volume vehicle. In Australia, at least, and it certainly would probably come at a premium. But I think it would be a really good image booster for Honda in Australia, and I think they would really benefit from one.
And to round out this week's news, we once again bring in Mike Costello. Hello, Moco.
Hello, Mandy.
Probably the biggest news ever for Honda in Australia broke this week. Can you tell us what it's all about?
Yeah, so Honda confirmed a little while ago that it was going to radically alter the way that it sells cars in Australia. So it basically recognized that it's not able to sell as many cars as it would like to profitably. So it's decided that it's only really going to sell a much smaller number of vehicles, about 1,600 a month, for a higher margin. And it's also radically changing its dealer network. So the way that a dealer network typically works is it's franchise dealer partners that sign franchise agreements with the car brand and then buy vehicles from the car brand and sell them to customers for a markup. And they negotiate the price with the customer, which is where the haggling comes in. And they also negotiate and fight other dealers in their around their catchment area to come up with the best prices possible. Honda's decided that it wants to introduce an agency model, which basically means that it will own all of the inventory at all times, giving customers access to its entire national database and fixing the price. So dealerships essentially become customer interface points, and they're the place where you look at the car and kick the tires and test the car, but you don't get to haggle anymore. And to do this, Honda's really also changed the makeup of its dealer network. So it's kept a few really big flagship metropolitan sites, but it's using what is called a hub and spoke model. So the spokes are smaller regional centres and smaller urban centres to sort of sit alongside those main dealerships. And essentially, Honda thinks that this is much more in line with what customers want. You know, they don't really want to haggle. They find it confusing. They don't like the fact that one dealer may have a blue car, one dealer may have a white car. This way, you've got access to everything. It's a model that we're seeing rolling out across the world. In fact, New Zealand Honda has been doing this for about 20 years now, and Mercedes-Benz is also moving to a similar model in Australia. Scott, you and I actually spoke with the head of Honda Australia this week. What are some other details that stick with you that I didn't just mention?
I think the thing that stood out to me about the conversation is that Honda is giving up on the volume game. We sort of tend to think of mainstream brands as, rather than chasing really high-end expensive sales, just making their money by selling a ton of cars. But I think what we're seeing with Honda and what's sort of been alluded to is that with rivalry from Kia and Hyundai and Nissan and Mazda, it's really, really tricky to beat its traditional competitors. And then there's competition coming from below as well. There's Chinese brands with really rapidly improving products, really good warranties and really sharp prices. So it's sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place. It can't necessarily outdo its traditional competitors. It's being squeezed from the bottom. And rather than like undercut itself and just try to sell a ton of cars at razor-thin margins, it's just kind of committing to doing something different. So we get a lot of commenters who get frustrated with the way Honda's run or things happen with Honda in Australia. Some of the products we don't get, some of the ones we do and how they look. This potentially opens the door to new stuff and to more Hondas that maybe we would have liked to see previously coming to Australia. I think that was the big takeaway from me. I think the other thing that stood out to me is that we know Honda has a really passionate fan base, and it has a lot of really loyal customers, and some of them are old and have just had Hondas their entire life. Some of them are younger people whose parents had Hondas. And in a world where you can't haggle with a dealer and you can't walk in and know the dealer principal like maybe you could previously, it makes it a little bit more tricky to walk in and go, oh, Will, we know you, we know your dad, and we know your dad's dad, and we can do you a deal. So it's interesting to me that Honda's actually really aware of this and has said that it's working on some sort of pricing or incentive for returning Honda customers, because I think one of the accusations people who get annoyed at Honda level at the company is forgetting about its fans. But clearly someone in head office or a lot of people in head office know that those return customers and the way people feel about the brand and people who've been around the brand for a long time sort of think about it is really important to them.
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes people underestimate when they complain about the lack of products that are sold in Australia is that Honda Australia often gets what it's given. You know, Australia is not a particularly important market to Honda, and so they're only quite limited in what they can sell. And as you say, Scotty, this does open the door to change out. There are a few things Honda's going to have to be careful about, though. First of all, there are people who love the haggle, and there's nothing for those people anymore. There is no scope to haggle. You go to a dealership and try and, you know, ask for $100 off, they literally are unable to do that for you. So that's not going to happen anymore. And the boss of Honda this week admitted that they're probably going to lose some sales over that. The other one has been keeping their dealer network on side. There was some controversy at a Senate inquiry last year where one of the major Honda dealers in Melbourne was complaining that basically their franchise was torn up before the end of the franchise agreement is what they say, and the compensation offered, they believe, was well unders. And there's been a little bit of argy-bargy between Honda and its dealers as it's tried to kind of push this through, which is inevitable when you make major structural changes. But we have seen it get a little bit ugly, and we've seen some of this spill out into the public sphere, which Honda clearly wouldn't have wanted. So it's going to have to juggle customer expectations and internal challenges to make this happen. No one said big changes and big reforms are going to be easy, but it's going to be one to watch over the next year or so to see how it settles in. I mean, luckily Honda has said that it's going to lose sales and it's ready to lose sales, so you can't criticize it too much for that when it invariably happens. But, you know, we're still going to have to keep an eye on how this actually goes. I do think a lot of car brands will be looking closely at it, though, because it's a model that they may want to imitate moving forwards.
I think this also sets the scene for the next step in Honda's evolution in Australia. I don't think it would be, you know, ridiculous to say that Honda's stuck in a bit of a holding pattern at the moment. All of its cars are good and spacious and relatively handsome, but with the exception of maybe the Civic Type R, which is just a brilliant thing to drive, none of them feel particularly exciting or stand out. With this change, Honda is also committed to bringing hybrid versions of every all-new model that comes to Australia. We know the next generation HR-V looks far more modern than the one we get at the moment, which is starting to feel very old. The new Civic looks really crisp and clean, and Honda's committed to bringing only the hatch, not the sedan. And then there's other bits and pieces of product. The Honda E is one of the things we've already talked about in news that hopefully down the track we'll get in Australia. So it does seem like Honda's decided that rather than trying to gradually overhaul things and arrest a sales slide and also arrest the changes in its model line, it's stuck a line in the sand and saying we need to start fresh and here's how we're doing it. And I'm quite excited to see from that line in the sand what happens next.
I think if you're a pessimist or an optimist, you're going to see this two different ways, right? If you're an optimist, you look at this and you say, well, look, Honda's being very shrewd. They're being very calculating. They're realizing their limitations and they're going to a model before any other mainstream brand does it. But if you're a pessimist, you look at this as, oh, this is just some Hail Mary. Maybe Honda just is kind of giving up. So I'm curious to see what you guys think about this decision. Like, on which side do you fall, glass half full or glass half empty?
Yeah, well, there's no secret that the car sales world is dying for reform. I mean, we're currently using a dealership model that's 50, 60 years old. It's quite antiquated. And, you know, we're looking at a world now of digital retail, online retail, car subscription services and sharing services. You know, it's a very different world that we live in today. And clearly OEMs are recognizing they need to change the way they sell product. And Honda, obviously, rather than sitting back and waiting on its haunches to see what everybody else does, has decided to actually do something, which, considering it's a brand that probably has been seen as being a little bit stagnant, often, you know, against its will when you consider that it has to bring cars from Thailand and it's had these massive Takata recalls and it's been cobbled by all sorts of natural disasters and things. But this is something innovative that Honda's doing. And, you know, I think it will be pretty well received at the end of the day. I think there'll be some teething pains, but I do think it's more in line with what the majority of people want.
Yeah, can't help but agree with Mike there.
Awesome. Has Honda Australia said anything about job losses at all? Do we know?
Not at this stage. So my understanding is, and Mike, correct me if I'm wrong here, but in head office there will likely be some changes because obviously the way cars are being sold or passed on to dealers is different, but there's no commitment to any job losses at the top. And all the dealerships that are no longer Honda dealers weren't actually working for Honda originally. They were independent franchises that signed on to sell the brand. So some of the Honda dealers in Melbourne that have already moved away from the brand have picked up other brands straight away. A lot of them have been Chinese brands as well from what I've seen. So, yeah, it's a bit tougher to put a finger on the job losses at a dealer level, but in the cases we've seen, anecdotally at least, it's been we're not selling Honda anymore, we're selling Great Wall, for example, and the people in the dealership put a different shirt on in the morning.
If you would like to read more of those stories, click the news link at carexpert.com.au. And thank you, Mike.
Thank you, guys.
Perhaps the most polarizing BMW models ever made, the M3 and M4. Tony Crawford got to drive the competition models around a track, and we just had to talk to him to get his opinion on them. Hello, Crawf.
How are you guys?
Very good. Now, we've got to say, giant grill aside, did they live up to your expectations?
They did.
Good.
I didn't like the previous generation M3 or M4.
Why is that?
Well, they always felt sketchy on a track. You never quite knew if they were going to stick in a fast corner. They certainly didn't stick in a slow corner if you were too anxious on the exit. And I got that from friends all around the world that are in this job, and they all said they didn't like that car. It was nowhere near as good as the V8 model. I think it was the E90, E92. That was a much more tied down car that was better balanced. And I never felt the F series? That was not a well balanced car. And I think it was unanimously supported, that comment, by, as I said, friends of mine that are in this job, you know, all over the world, including Germany for that matter. No one liked that car. I didn't even really like the look of that car. I know that's a bit of a statement based on the new cars with that giant schnoz.
Okay, so which one does look better, the previous model or the car?
I think the V8 was the sort of the last of the really look, I didn't mind the F series, but I think the V8 looked really good. E92, E90 and E93, was it? I'm not sure what the third one was, the convertible. This is another thing with BMW. I mean, you know, it's still hard to, you know, for me when I grew up, it was just the M3. That was it. You had an M3 two-door and you had an M3 four-door and you had an M3 convertible. Now we've gone into the, you know, these different nomenclature with M3, M4. And but, you know, you're right, grill aside, I actually started to, look, let's get one thing straight. This is not going to win any automotive design awards. Because of that front grill. but at the end of the day, this is a performance car, and people that buy this car are looking for a lot more bang out of their daily than the average run-of-the-mill milk freight series, you know, 3 series and 4 series. And I was really hoping that this car, and I think, you know, full call out to BMW for doing it on track initially, because, you know, the track sorts out any road car. It exposes all the flaws, all the faults, very quickly, in fact. And even though you're on road tires, these cars performed exceptionally well. I've never been one that frothed over the M4 or the two-door. I think the days are long gone when BMW made a really pretty two-door. That was in, for me, that was the 70s, 80s. Even 60s for that matter, they made great looking cars that would win design awards all around the world. And it's a real shame that BMW have not apply that same design process to their cars these days. I think the M8 looks good. That's probably one of the few cars that looks good. I think the M2 looks good. We'll talk about that another time. I also drove the M2 CS, which, to be honest, was my favorite car. But let's go back to the M3, which was my favorite car. And the reason I love the M3, I don't know about you guys, but the M4 has a wider track at the rear, so it doesn't need the guards pushed out as much. So the M3 is a narrower track at the rear, so the guards have always been pushed really far out. It's like 7 inches out, and it looks fantastic from behind. And that car has always looked fantastic. And I think where the M4 falls down for me is there's such a wide expanse of metal with nothing going on. There's no vents down there on the C-pillar, nothing. It's just blank metal. And I don't know, it just doesn't look resolved to me.
There's three different models of the M3 and M4. There's the competition, all-wheel drive, and the rear-wheel drive manual.
Yes.
Which was the one that you drove at Phillip Island?
M3 and M4 competition. That were the only cars that I drove.
So that's the rear-wheel drive.
The rear-wheel drive competition version. So you can get the standard versions, which are only manual. The only manual car I drove on the day was an M2 CS manual, which is very interesting and very fun. And so, yes, they're a bit cheaper. They're quite a bit cheaper, but they also have less power and torque, quite substantially less, in fact. I've always thought that, you know, the fact that they have the competition, surely you'd buy the competition, right? You're in that market, unless you specifically want a manual car, which you'd be forced to take the lower power, lower torque model. The all-wheel drive is coming later at the end, I think third or fourth quarter. That'll be a very interesting car. You know, you'll be able to get off the line quicker. The top acceleration performance on the competition models, both M3 and M4, is 3.9. I'm betting the all-wheel drive has got to be 3.8, maybe 3.7, because you're just going to have so much more traction off the line. Most all-wheel drive performance cars do lower the 0 to 100 of about 0.2. So this will be interesting. And, of course, we have the Touring, which I think is going to be the hero car of this whole lineup of M cars. That's going to be special. And for my money, I'd absolutely 100% buy that. If you're into surfing, you're into bike riding, and you need to haul some sporting equipment or some dive gear, I mean, what's the point of having a boot? Just, you know, throw that hatch up and shove all that stuff in. I'm not sure. I guess that's going to be all-wheel drive, the Touring. I don't know whether that – yeah.
So our understanding at this stage is that the Touring will, and this is based on overseas reports for the moment, but the Touring will launch in Europe in late 2022, and it's expected to be only the xDrive competition. So the top spec powertrain, basically, which kind of makes sense given it's the more practical option that it has all-wheel drive, and it's a rival for the Audi RS4.
I think it's a good thing. Otherwise, I think there'd be a few around poles. Because that thing would be sideways.
Engine donor cars.
Yeah.
How did they drive around the track?
They were exceptional. I have a video on carexpert.com.au, which I did about 3 laps on that video, and I think they edited it into 1 lap, which is good. And I've never actually liked Phillip Island. I've driven on, I'd say, probably 20 tracks around the world. It's my least favorite track. I think you need a lot of laps to really push. And funnily enough, by the end of the session when I did this recording and did the video, I was pushing hard in the M3, as hard as I would want to push. And that was all the car. The car was pointy. The car was balanced. The car felt good in corners. The car felt sticky. It had Pilot Sport 4Ss, which are very, very good tyres. I've got them on one of my cars, and I love them. But apart from that, this was a car you could literally throw into a corner, and I've not been able to say that about an M3 or an M4 for some time. The M4 was always even worse for me. This time around, the M4 is pretty much point-to-point with the M3 in terms of balance, which I thought was really good and really fun. We actually did a bit of drifting in these cars too on a skid pan, and they were much easier to drift than the previous gen, which is another good thing. Not that you want to be drifting on public roads on the M3 and the M4. Yeah, so look, I really enjoyed the cars. The interior's great. It's got some fantastic seats. I don't know who is listening to this podcast saw the Kailami orange leather with the Isle of Man green, but that is my favorite.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'd have to buy that. Like, I know it's out there, but I would feel like I was cheating myself if I bought a gray or a, you know, even a matte gray like Marek's. No, I think Marek has sold that car. I can't call it his Supra anymore. I believe
he sold the Supra.
Exited the Supra because he felt he was had an inferior product, I guess, to the new one.
So, Corf, M3 or M4?
M3 for me all day long. The practicality, the fact that I think it looks better. They have wider rear guards, and if you don't like a performance car with wide rear guards, then I think there's something wrong with you. But that's my opinion. But look, I think everyone's complaining about the price of the M2 CS that we also drove on the day. It's about $139,000, quite a bit up on the M2 competition. But I'm telling you, that car is fast. That car is at least 2 or 3 seconds quicker a lap than the M3. And you can really throw it into tight corners, and it sticks and it's quick. And I think that would be my preference if I was in the market for an M car and I didn't have kids. It would be M2 CS all day long. I don't care that it's extra money. I think 139 grand rather than 154,000. I think for the M3 competition, 159,000 for the M3, M4 is the dearer one. I think for 139, the M2 is a faster car, and you get, you know, for my mind, it's a better handling car. Because it's tighter. But, yeah, look, they're going to sell a bunch of these cars. They're the best they've made in years. And, look, you've obviously got to get over the schnoz. If you can get over that, then I think you're going to really love what they've done with this car. There's a lot of bracing in this car. It's a lot stiffer. And I think they knew the fact that they had produced not such a great car last time around, and I think they got it all right because there's been a lot of work underneath the skin for this car, and it shows on track.
All right, that sounds like a good wrap there. You can read the reviews of the M3 and M4 combined live now at carexpert.com.au. Thank you so much, Croft.
Thank you, guys.
One of the most affordable plug-in hybrid SUVs money can buy is here, the 2021 MG HS FEV, or plug-in hybrid. Will, you've driven it. Did this car surprise you?
Yes, it did. I'd driven the regular HS before, so that was actually the first vehicle launch I went to with Car Expert. So 12 months later, as promised, MG was rolling out more models for the HS range. So in addition to adding the plug-in hybrid, they're also adding an all-wheel drive turbocharged 2-litre four-cylinder model. But the plug-in hybrid is really interesting because there's really not much competition out there. There's really not. Mitsubishi has just basically had this segment to itself with the Outlander FEV for several years now. That came out, and correct me if I'm wrong, Scully, that came out like 2014. So
yeah, the Outlander was a really early sort of player in the game, and no one else has really joined since. So although there's few more coming, yeah, the HS really does walk into a space that's ready for it.
Exactly. And look, there are some companies who have plug-in hybrids available in other markets that are not bringing them here. So the Toyota RAV4 is available with a plug-in hybrid powertrain in Japan, which apparently is fantastic, and yet they're not bringing it here, even though the hybrid sells like hotcakes and they can barely keep them on dealer lots. So there are other options available overseas, but here it's pretty much Mitsubishi's had it all to itself. Well, now they've got a little bit of competition with the MG HS plug-in hybrid. Later this year, they'll also have the Ford Escape FEV, and Peugeot is actually rolling out a plug-in hybrid 3008 this year as well. So finally, cool. There's some activity here. Competition is always
stays good. And in fact, Mitsubishi's going to have a new Outlander FEV. They've already revealed the new Outlander, and there'll no doubt be a FEV version coming, potentially a FEV version of this next trail. So yeah, it's starting to happen now. But kudos to MG for actually rolling out a plug-in hybrid here when nobody was kind of really expecting them to. This follows just a few months after rolling out their first all-electric vehicle, the ZS EV. So what you get with the HS plug-in hybrid is a 1.5-litre turbocharged four-cylinder petrol engine mated with an electric motor. So combined, they produce 189 kilowatts of power and 370 newton metres of torque, which sounds like a lot for a front-wheel drive vehicle. Didn't really feel that way out on the road, which is a good thing. I thought it was going to be a torque steering mess. It was, as launch events tend to be, it was a pretty limited drive. It was, you know, drive out somewhere nice and come back. So I want to see how it actually performs in, you know, in my hood. But what you get with this powertrain is a claimed 52 kilometers of electric range. Under the stricter WLTP cycle.
Is that more than the Outlander?
Yeah, so the Outlander has 54 kilometres of range, but that's under the NEDC cycle. Yeah, that's, you know, typically less. If you're curious, if you heard those power figures and that was the first thing you thought of instead of economy figures, it has a 0 to 100 kilometre hour time of 6.9 seconds. So that's pretty good for a midsize SUV. Hmm. It's not a dramatically exciting vehicle to drive. I can't really imagine how many midsize SUVs are. I've certainly driven a lot of them and none of them really stand out in that respect. So if you're expecting some, you know, pocket rocket, you know, corner carver, no, that's not it. But what you do get is a very smooth vehicle. It doles out the power quite smoothly, for lack of another word. I'll get out my thesaurus in a second. Its ride quality is quite impressive as well. We drove over some pretty crappy roads, and it was absorbing bumps and ruts quite well. So it does the kind of fundamental things you'd expect of a midsize SUV.
Will, a lot of the feedback we've heard about cars like the HS and even the ZST to a lesser extent is that they're very, very close, but there are still things that make them feel, call it 5 or 10% behind the more established car brands. Does that also ring true with the FEV, or does the fact that it's a plug-in hybrid and China has some real expertise in that area give it a leap ahead of its rivals instead?
It's a good question. There are certainly a few things that need work with this. So MG doesn't do local suspension tuning or local chassis tuning. And there are a couple of aspects dynamically that even for a midsize SUV, which are never really that exciting, need a little bit of work. The steering in corners is surprisingly heavy, like to the point where it's not just me, an enthusiast, complaining about it. It's potentially somebody, you know, driving it to get groceries and taking a roundabout, finding it a bit of a handful or two hands.
Doing 3-point turns would be a big handful.
Yeah, exactly. And the infotainment, I've said this before about MG products, it does still need a little finessing. I clicked on the navigation while I was in the car, and as it does in MGs, it takes a little while to load to begin with when you first start the vehicle. But then when it opened, I'm like, this looks exactly like the navigation in my Genesis. Which was just like a Hyundai. Yeah, and I'm like, because the Genesis didn't have like some fancy bespoke infotainment UI like the current Genesis models do. Mine just used standard kind of 2015 Hyundai UI. So in that respect, like the factory nav, if you use it, a lot of people just use smartphone mirroring, it does look like a generation old Hyundai navigation system. So look, that the infotainment needs, the layout and the design of it needs a little bit of work as well. But the interior, I want to talk about the interior because it's fundamentally the same as a regular HSU. You've got a different shifter. You don't have paddle shifters. But MG has brought it here in just one highly specified trim level, which corresponds with the Essence, which is the top spec HS model. And even in a base HS, the interior is surprisingly nice. There's a good use of soft touch plastics. There's an attractive design. There's some really nice like metal look elements on the dashboard and the rear armrest that just look really nice. Like it's fundamentally a the Chinese have come a long way, and this is a good-looking interior. Now, what's interesting as well is the price, because I had a feeling you're probably going to ask me that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's priced at $45,990 before on-roads, but MG is initially offering it at $46,990 drive-away. Now, the cheapest Outlander FEV is $47,990 before on-roads, and that's just the base ES model. So it doesn't have, you know, the same high level of equipment as this HS does. When the Ford Escape ST line FEV comes here later this year, it's going to cost $52,490 before on roads. So it's not massively like stupendously undercutting its rivals, but it's still undercutting them and offering a high level of equipment, as you would expect from a challenger brand like MG.
It's also worth remembering that the Outlander FEV that maybe we'll see in the future is probably going to be more expensive again, because there's a new model that we're expecting to launch at some point in the next 12 months. We've seen the petrol car, not the plug-in hybrid car. But with all the equipment it gets, the size of it, it's likely to be a more expensive car as new generations are, and that's going to only further the HS's advantage there. So, I mean, as MG has tended to do previously, it just seems like it's found a little niche that it can undercut rivals on and still offer a really strong product. And it's wedged its way in there. It's going to be really interesting to see how it takes off.
And what's interesting as well is that MG is offering two, as they call them, new energy vehicles in a very similar, in the same kind of price range. Because just you go down a few grand and you've got the all-electric ZS, which, yes, is a smaller car, but they've got all-electric and they've got plug-in hybrid. Some rivals don't even have one of those, let alone both.
Mm.
So kudos to MG for bringing both of those vehicles over. And I'm keen to find out how well this will sell, as well as the ZSEV.
All right, you can check out that full review live now at carexpert.com.au. That is the end of this week's podcast. If you would like to get in touch with us, you can email podcast@carexpert.com.au. We would love to hear from you. Hey, Will, what cars have we got coming up next week?
We have many cars coming up. So down in Melbourne, there's the new Renault Captur. They also have down there a Mini Countryman John Cooper Works. Oh, Mini John Cooper Works Countryman. Gotta say it the way they say it. A Toyota Corolla ZR hatch. I don't know if that's the hybrid or the regular petrol model. A few utes. So there's a Mazda BT50 and its Isuzu D-Max twin under the skin, and the 2021 Nissan Navara in STX trim. There's also a Skoda Scala Monte Carlo and a Lexus NX300H. So we've already seen the next generation NX, the next generation leaked.
I like what you did there.
So this will probably be one of the last reviews we do for the current one. In Sydney, looks like they've only got one car, a Toyota Hilux Rugged X, which is, you know, a step or two above what we've got up here, which is a Hilux SR5, but it's with the manual transmission. Up here in Brisbane, I know I'm currently in a Nissan X-Trail TI.
Sexy.
Yeah. No, it's a
you
little.
Say that?
It's all right. It's all right. But ATCO, I believe, will be getting his hot little hands on a Jaguar F-Type R. So,
nice.
Very similar to the X-Trail, that bad boy.
Oh,
very
speaking similar. Of sexy. Yeah. Anything worth mentioning on the site coming up, Scully?
Everything's worth mentioning on the site, Mandy. It's all good. But this weekend, so by the time you listen to this, this will be live, but Derek has put together a really good story wrapping up global auto sales for 2020. Think of it as VFAX, but just for the world for a year.
Cool.
It's a really, really comprehensive wrap that he's put together, and I'm really excited to read it. I haven't edited it yet, so it should be live on Saturday or Sunday. The other one worth calling out is one that Will's working on at the moment, but won't necessarily be live when this podcast goes live. And that's a story about ANCAP and the best-selling cars in Australia without a rating. Because obviously the Mitsubishi Express last week put in the spotlight the fact that ANCAP ratings have some quirks about them and how they're administered. And this is a little look at why some cars don't have ratings but still sell really well. So looking forward to pushing that one live as well.
Fantastic. All right, guys, have a lovely weekend. Thank you very much, William Stopford and Scott Colley.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.